This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm speaking with Daniel Jaffe, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Portland State University and author of the new book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Jaffe's research examines conflicts over water privatization and commodification in both the global North and South, and he also studies the international fair trade movement and social movements around food and agriculture. Among his other publications, his book, Brewing Justice, Fair Trade, Coffee, Sustainability, and Survival, received the C. Wright Mills Book Award. Well, welcome to KBOO, Daniel Jaffe.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, Daniel, I think most KBOO listeners are aware of the environmental damage that single-use plastic water bottles have caused. But your book importantly notes how, in addition to the energy footprint up to 2,000 times higher than tap water, the growing commodification of water has threatened a basic right, access to clean drinking water. How has this phenomenon of bottled water, which was hardly a thing 20 years ago, led to this crisis in public water systems?
Right. So it is worth getting a handle on the explosive growth of this relatively new product, this new commodity. Right? It's gone from, you know, virtually nothing 4 decades ago to the world's most consumed packaged beverage today. The world consumed 120 billion gallons in 2021. It's far and away the single most consumed packaged beverage, which means it is also incidentally responsible for the biggest share of the 600 to 700 billion single-use plastic bottles that are consumed and mostly disposed every year. So that's really important. Become a $300 billion industry worldwide and counting. In the US, it's grown to $46 billion, right? It has become ubiquitous. Nearly 9 in 10 people in the US consume it. And what I say in the book, Unbottled, is that, you know, obviously bottled water is more than just a controversial product with a lot of negative environmental impacts. It also ends up being, you know, deeply connected to the social justice crisis of uneven access to safe and affordable water, both domestically here in the US and on a global scale. And that growing spending on bottled and packaged water and growing dependence on that product is exacerbating already wide economic and racial inequalities between the clean water haves and the clean water have nots, again, kind of both domestically and globally. And I think that for various reasons, the bottled and packaged water industry, which is sort of led by four really the biggest names in sort of food and beverage firms, Coke, Pepsi, Nestle, and Danone, takes advantage of gaps in clean water provision, particularly across the global South. And so I write that this continued growth of bottled water and its either supplanting or its replacing of tap water for drinking ultimately is posing a threat to our public water systems in places that have widespread access to largely clean, safe tap water 24/7, and also more broadly to the human right to safe drinking water around the world.
Well, let's go to Flint, Michigan, where you begin your story. And I think most listeners will remember a decade ago that the city's polluted and toxic water system was endangering the health of residents who were, ironically, as you point out, provided plastic water from Nestle, which was draining Michigan water supplies for its own profits in the packaged water business. Give us an update on the Flint story, since we haven't heard much about it in recent years.
Right. So people probably are aware that the Flint crisis is directly tied to neoliberal austerity, essentially a Republican governor who replaced essentially or overrode the city's democratically elected local officials, the city council and mayor, with a gubernatorially appointed emergency manager who essentially had fiat power over many important city decisions, ostensibly to sort of save the city from its financial woes. But the emergency manager, a series of emergency managers provided presided over a series of just fateful and ultimately a truly awful decisions to switch the city's drinking water source from the very clean and long established Detroit water system to the polluted Flint River while it was waiting to hook up to a new pipeline to Lake Huron. And in so doing, inadequate treatment of the water led to rapid leaching of lead, other heavy metals, and bacteria from the city's water pipes, essentially destroying the water system and exposing Flint residents, a majority of whom were African-American, high rate of poverty, for 18 months to toxic drinking water. There's no other way to say it. It's an extreme example of environmental injustice. And obviously, in drinking water emergencies like Flint, affected residents need an immediate, clean, safe alternative source of drinking water. What was provided in the immediate aftermath of the revelations of the unsafe water was, you saw the images, hundreds of millions of bottles of single serving plastic bottled water in these, you know, multi-packs and pallets full, being distributed by volunteers, nonprofits, and then for a couple of years distributed free by the state of Michigan. Most of it, not all of it, coming from Nestle's branded water, some of that coming from groundwater, some of that coming from public water supplies elsewhere. And then the question is, though, you know, what happens after the immediate emergency? And what I talk about in Flint and what has happened, you know, Flint is essentially just the tip of the iceberg, but in a string of these sort of increasingly high profile drinking water emergencies around the US, is that we see that the default response is to turn to private plastic packaged water. And concerningly, this product becomes the alternative, quote unquote, safe water supply, not just for the immediate crisis, but increasingly for the medium term and even for the long term. 7 years after, 8 years after the Flint contamination was revealed, the city has, with federal funds, with state funds, has replaced about 95% of the lead contaminated service lines, virtually all, but contaminated and lead-lined piping remains inside people's houses, remains inside appliances. The appliances and internal piping is just severely damaged, and residents largely distrust their tap water pretty profoundly. Now, stepping back just a second, in the earlier days of the crisis in Flint, the disaster in Flint, both local activist groups who had initially mobilized to demand the right to get bottled water distribution, but they, and then eventually the governor, asked the federal government, the Obama administration at the time, for a declaration of a major disaster. That would have, many argue, enabled them to get an alternative source of water, bulk water supplies in tanker trucks, something called water buffaloes that bring huge quantities of bulk water where residents could fill their own containers. That declaration was denied by the federal administration. And so what that meant was that for the duration of, really up until now, single-use plastic private bottled water has become the sole face of the response to the crisis. And that because residents have had their trust so damaged, many Flint residents, thousands and thousands of Flint residents, still depend on bottled water today for all of their drinking, but also cooking and sometimes other uses. And we see this pattern emerging in different parts of the U.S. And if you step back a little bit to look at the root causes of the broader deterioration of public water infrastructure in the U.S., we see a nearly five-decade process of federal disinvestment in supporting drinking water systems. Federal government funding for public water systems has dropped by about 80% adjusted for inflation since 1977, and that fiscal pain just gets passed down to cities and municipalities and localities, most of whom sort of make do and patch up the holes, but have to raise water bills and sewer bills as a result. But it is also in the poorest communities, ones with high rates of poverty, and largely communities dominated by communities of color, increasingly we see communities that are faced with real threats to drinking water safety.
And this just happened in Jackson, Mississippi a year or two ago.
And so, yes, the capital of Mississippi, Jackson, Mississippi, a largely African-American city And I should emphasize that overwhelming majority of tap water provided by public water systems in the U.S. remains safe to drink and does not violate any of the health provisions of the Safe Drinking Water Act. But about 7 to 8% of water systems in the U.S. every year do have one of those health-related violations. Some of them are fixed very quickly, but that 7 to 8% is not randomly distributed. It's overwhelmingly concentrated in rural communities, small water systems, and overwhelmingly communities that are low-income, Black, and Latino, Latina. And so we have really not a water safety problem in this country, but a water injustice problem in this country. And not surprisingly, communities of color and low-income people, surveys and academic research shows this just incontrovertibly, far more distrust their tap water than do white and middle and upper income households. And they disproportionately are turning away from that tap water and turning toward bottled water. They are spending much more on bottled water on average, something like 2 to 1. And that higher spending is, of course, falling on the social groups who on average are least financially able to bear that extra burden. And so you see household spending hundreds, and in many cases, because they're using it for cooking as well, thousands of dollars per year to meet their cooking and drinking needs with bottled and packaged water. In some cases, they're turning away from water that is perfectly safe to drink. In other cases, they're turning away from water that is compromised. But I think rather than talk about any notion of misperceptions, I think we could look at this as a rational response by those communities to the history of systemic racism in the United States and the uneven distribution of those risks.
Right. And as you point out, that most of the bottled water in the United States does come from tap water sources.
Indeed.
But in addition to this kind of environmental injustice in the global north, in the United States, let's look at the global south or the majority world, where because of colonial legacies, debt, and austerity, many governments have been unable to extend tap water systems to their residents. And how have these global corporations dominated international discussions of water access? Right. And how's the global justice water movement challenging it?
Yeah, right. So in both the communities that represent kind of the South within the global North, the ones I've just been talking about, and also large swaths of the global South, urban, peri-urban areas, many places that the water system just have not been built out, not been extended to reach the majority of the population. Or if they do, systems can't adequately treat the water, or the water doesn't flow consistently. And so that becomes a problem of consistent access. And so, yes, the packaged water industry has been happy to sort of step in and fill the gap caused by all those factors you just described, where governments are either unable or unwilling, or a combination, to meet the needs of their citizens, residents, with clean, safe water. And so we see a pattern where overwhelmingly across the global South, bottled water is growing fastest, especially in Asia and parts of the Middle East and around the global South as well. And in fact, you know, this is a big point of contention, because the packaged water industry, and I should say that in the global South, there is a real drinking water, bottled water consumption is classed. You've got the kind of the branded water, the big four that I mentioned, own about, you know, a lot of subsidiaries in the global South. And that's about, you know, maybe a third to half of the consumption. But the other half is what some people call the water of the poor, refilling providers who take, you know, local groundwater, surface water supplies, or take straight from local tap water systems and filter the water and sell it at local refilling points. People bring their own containers, and that is cheaper and quality varies. But across the board, you see an increasing dependence on packaged water. And so that contentious issue has sort of entered into debates around meeting international goals for increasing access to safe water, like the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. And very quickly, there was a controversial decision made back in 2017 to reclassify packaged water as a so-called improved water source for the purposes of national governments meeting their targets under the Sustainable Development Goal number 6 for improving water access. And that's quite contentious, because it essentially absolves governments of the need to build out their water infrastructure and enables them to count the growth of the packaged water industry as a way of meeting those needs. Now, the resistance, you asked about the resistance, and yes, the book is centered on the movements that are challenging packaged water. And the global water justice movement emerged around the global South and North for about the last 20 years. They were the ones who fought a successful battle to get the UN to declare a human right to water and sanitation back in 2010. They've also fought privatization of drinking water systems and fought to support and sustain local public and community water systems. But what's less known and less attention is paid to the movements challenging packaged water. And I sort of argue that we need to really keep our eyes on packaged water and bottled water because it's the fastest growing form of the privatization or the commodification of drinking water worldwide. It's moving faster than the private water utility services industry. And as a result, I think we need to focus on movements challenging that. And around the world, I sort of say there's two facets. One is places where communities and movements are challenging the extraction of groundwater, sort of at the source, places where water is being extracted. But more interestingly, maybe this reclaim the tap facet of the movement, which is this kind of panoply, this constellation of really exciting initiatives bubbling up in local governments, university students, nonprofit organizations, even private businesses around the global North, but increasingly in the South as well, where it's essentially a turning back to public tap water, a demand that we revindicate or revalorize public tap water, building out networks of clean, new, shiny drinking fountains and water refilling stations. There are even apps people can download, like the Refill app, telling them where they can find the nearest source of water to refill these refillable water bottles. And it's a movement that's actually really caught on among young folks and Generation Z. And I quote bottled water industry reports and officials who are extremely concerned about the bite this is taking out of bottled water sales. And we are actually seeing a slowing and even a stalling of the growth in bottled water sales across the global North. First, it was Europe, then it was the UK, then it was Canada. And now in the US, bottled water sales have essentially flatlined in the last year. And I think a lot of it is owed to this movement back to the tap. But just to close the circle, I think we now have sort of two counter forces. One is more privileged people in the global North increasingly are rejecting bottled water and turning back to and revaluing tap water and refilling. But communities of color, low-income communities facing disproportionate challenges to their water safety or strong perceptions that they are exposed to greater risk are still consuming more bottled water. And I think that unless we reinvest at the federal level here in the US in rebuilding and restoring our shared treasure of public water systems that we and our ancestors have been paying for decades and centuries, we will not restore trust in public water across the board unless we reinvest to make water reliably safe and trustworthy again for all of us.
And the right to include safe drinking water as a public good, a public right, along with many other rights that we have for housing, food, clean air, et cetera. And you provide some great examples of hundreds of cities around the world that have been working to re-municipalize their water systems, moving away from those private systems back to publicly funded systems that support all residents.
Right. And the last thing I'll mention in this reclaiming the tap facet is that these networks, both of anti-privatization movements, this is the facet that really, this links the opposition to bottled and packaged water with the opposition to privatization. In increasingly international initiatives, one of which came out of Canada, but is now global, called the Blue Communities Initiative, is signing on local governments, universities, school districts, churches, et cetera, to a program where they support keeping water public, supporting the right to water, and banning bottled water in local governments and restoring access to public water in public places. This Blue Communities Initiative, they have 77 cities in 8 countries, and it is growing. And that's kind of the internationalization of the resistance to packaged water and the fight for clean water as a human right that I think really holds quite a lot of promise. And just overall, this topic the more I researched the book and the farther I got into writing it, the more hopeful I felt about the prospect for a pushback against the commodification of water, at least on this particular front.
Well, thank you, Daniel Jaffe, for joining us on the Old Mill Variety Hour today. And I want to encourage listeners to check out your important book, Unbottled, The Fight Against Plastic Water and for Water Justice. Thanks again, Daniel.
Thanks so much, Lori. I enjoyed it.